This is Tracy.
And this is Sheila, and we are Spy Fat Chicks. And this week's episode is about a great book by Tom Parker Bowles named A Year of Eating Dangerously.
Yes, The Year of Eating Dangerously. And we've been pumping this book up for like a month now, I think. We'd seen it at the bookstore, and we said, we'd like to get a copy and check that out sometime. Went back to the bookstore to pick it up, and lo and behold, they were rotating in, I think, the trade paperback editions. Mm-hmm. So some of the hardbacks were the discount rack. So yeah. We scooped one of those up right away. Ironically enough, we got the hardback first edition cheaper than the reprint and trade.
Go figure. Which is kind of weird, but...
Yes.
Sometimes you get lucky like that, and you catch deals.
I'm glad we picked it up. I would have paid full price for it happily. It's that good.
Yes.
I blew through it in, what, a day? I think you did a day and a half,
yeah.
If that. It's an outstanding book. The author, I'm just going to call him Tom. I'm going to pretend we know him. Tom.
Cool by association.
Because I know I'm going to keep Tom, saying vowels instead of bowls for the name. So, Tom.
This is less of a disgrace, Tom.
Yes, trust us,
to
Tom.
Call you on a first name basis, even though we don't know you other than trying to say your last name.
You would much rather we call you Tom right now than continue to associate your last name with guts. So, Tom wrote the book. He picked 9 different areas that... really pertain to food areas, but they encompass all kinds of different cuisines that are considered dangerous foods that he wanted to check out. Maybe eating the food itself is dangerous, and maybe the culture that's attached to it is dangerous.
Stuff that's on the edge.
Yes.
He wanted to really get beyond the bland, how he considers it, stuff that's available in the supermarket, your mm-hmm. everyday ho-hum cuisine.
Yes.
He really wanted to stretch his own personal limits and the limits of his home culture.
Yes.
Which is British.
Yeah. And... he writes a regular column for a British newspaper. I don't remember the name of the newspaper off the top of my head, but we will post a link up to it. The column is hilarious. He is hilarious. He has the style of writing that makes it a joy to read. On a literary level, it's just fun.
His books are explicit, though. There is F-bombs aplenty being dropped. But not necessarily all by him, because he goes right with direct quotes from the people that he's encountering. And some of them are really foul-mouthed, which I have no problem with. I'm wondering if we should rate this as being explicit.
No, because we're not going to quote directly. We'll censor it. But, I would give this to a teenager to read without hesitation. I don't think I'd give this to an 8-year-old. I don't think they could read it or appreciate it.
The only thing inappropriate is the language.
Yes. There's nothing else inappropriate in it. Most kids know don't say those words.
Right.
So, yeah. I would give this to Katie to read, my niece.
Yeah.
So, Michelle, we're going to send her a copy now. What? Anyway.
F-bomb.
Well, I love the introduction of this book. I love this man. He is so awesome. Usually, I don't care if I were to ever meet a famous person, because I know I would have nothing to say to them, because people who are actors, what are you going to say? Yeah, I like the person you play on the screen, but you're probably really a jerk compared to them. You have nothing in common.
Right.
But this dude, he loves food, and he loves all kinds of food. He was talking in the introduction about his love affair with American cuisine.
Yeah.
When he was a kid, how he went through prep school and how bad the food was and how it was exciting to come to the States and eat
fast junk food
and go to our grocery stores. And somebody who can appreciate American junk food and then go around and appreciate all these other things that he eats, the dude has to just rock.
Exactly.
I would love to sit back and share a couple pictures with him.
Yes.
And the man can drink.
Yeah.
So. If there is an overall theme for this entire book, it is, I really shouldn't have drank nearly as much as I did. So.
Because facing some of the things that he did first thing in the morning with a hangover, my God. He is a braver soul than I.
Dim sum with a hangover is horrible. I know you think it's wonderful. It's just...
it's not a replacement for the greasy breakfast, but I can handle it. But let me tell you, when I was younger, it was kind of hairy whenever we party on Saturday night and go for dim sum on Sunday morning. Dim sum with a hangover, your saving grace is all that green tea.
Yeah.
The unlimited green tea.
So...
and you're just like, oh, so squishy. Ow.
Oh, they're showing us bits to see if we want them.
Ugh, no, they know I don't want the chicken feet. Why are they waving them at me? Anyway,
so we're going to jump through this book pretty much chapter by chapter. Each chapter is its own self-contained little story of the type of food or culture that he's going for his that component of the year of eating dangerously.
And the only thing he didn't really get a chance to eat was the subject of the first chapter.
Yes.
It's because they're just so... valuable now, even mm-hmm. though they used to be trash, which is a lot of... you see that in seafood, a lot of trends. Things that, like monkfish, that they used to just throw away or feed to dogs.
Tuna.
Yeah, are now high-ticket items.
The tuna from sushi economy.
Yeah.
Where they're running around, the fish that used to be practically given away at the docks now are going for thousands of dollars. It's amazing. Yeah. So the first chapter is in his home territory in jolly old England.
Darling jolly old England.
Darling jolly old England. And it is elvers, which I'd never heard of before.
Neither had I.
These are baby eels. Little tiny wee, like, not even a shoestring size. Think, like, spaghetti size or smaller eels. Yeah.
And only a couple inches, too, right?
Yeah, they're really small, really thin, really tiny. And it used to be a thing to go fishing for them. And then there were all these neat little local dishes around. I don't remember what river it's on. Do you?
No.
But the eels come swimming up the river when they're born. And then they nest in the rivers and get bigger. And then they go back out to sea.
Yeah.
So it turns out we don't know how to make eels breed in captivity.
It's one of those weird things, like, they're not sure how bumblebees fly and all that jazz. I mean, obviously it's possible, but they're not sure of the physics of it.
Yes.
They're not sure how eels breed.
Severn. Ah.
The Severn River?
Severn Elver Runs. Yeah, there we go. Severn. So, it used to be back in the day, they'd fry them up into, like, eel loaves or make another dish with them, and you'd eat the eel whole, all the crunchy bits and everything, because they're so thin, you don't have a problem. It's like,
Like anchovies.
Anchovies and sardines. Don't you eat the crunchy Everything. Bits with it? Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not all that crunchy because it's so small, to be honest.
But there's an appetite for eels now in the world economy that we didn't see 30 or 40 or 50 years ago, especially with the Japanese. I mean, they love eel.
Yeah.
Well, Sheila loves eel. Sheila could single-handedly decimate the eel economy.
I understand why they love eel, because it's delicious, especially
barbecue
with barbecue.
Eel. Oh. So...
So they can't even really eat the elvers now because
they're so much more
they
valuable.
Harvest them and they let them grow to full size. Mm-hmm. They're sold to, like, aquaculture farms.
Exactly. So rather than frying them up like they used to because it was just junk fish,
they sell them
for millions of pounds.
Yeah.
It's a, what did they say, a 250,000 pound...
Industry?
Industry or something like that. Multi-million pound industry, I'm sorry. And it's a very short period of time where you can harvest these eels when they go on their run. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of hazardous. It used to be just anybody could go down and dip a net in, but now because it's worth so much money, you get people who go down to their little
poaching.
Spot in the river, and they hire guards to watch their spot. Think like ex-Pinkertons and some such stuff.
Yeah.
So it can be a little dangerous, which it fulfills the component for this chapter for the eating dangerously part. It's not the food that's dangerous, it's the acquisition
Acquiring
of the
of
food
it.
Can be a little bit scary.
Exactly. Well, and you have to be licensed to do it, and mm-hmm. there's always people that are poaching.
Yes.
And there's police that patrol to check people's licenses, and then there's thugs that patrol that are hired by fishermen to keep their secret spot safe.
Yes. It's crazy. And then you have the old guys who are like, whoa, back in my day, anybody could dip a net down and get whatever they wanted, and we didn't have to worry about this, because back in their day, they weren't worth anything either.
Yeah.
And the saddest part of all is that it's... There aren't nearly as many elvers. And elvers, by the way, is the name for the baby eels.
Right.
I don't know if we established
it's like
that
a
early on.
Is a baby goose.
Yes.
An elver is a baby eel.
Yes. It's like the local name for the baby eels. There aren't nearly as many elvers as there used to be. They used to just be able to dip like a cup into the river and come up with a pint of them.
Right.
And now they're lucky, each fisherman's lucky to get a pound or so, or a kilo or so a night.
Yeah.
They're thinning out the herd, which is very bad.
Right. It just makes me picture... Old world explorers came to Canada and the sea would be writhing with cod in the moonlight. That's what I picture the river being like, just squirming with elvers. And now, not so much.
Yeah.
Goodbye, reggae car.
So, I would try elvers if I could ever afford them, but I know I can't.
No. They're not being eaten. They're being sold to be bigger eels so that they can be consumed by me in a hand roll.
Yes. Very sadly, Tom was unable to acquire any elvers for actual consumption during the trip, so he did not get to have elvers. There was another food throughout the entire book he never got a chance to acquire either. It was that bird.
It's in France, and it's a whole bird that's deep fried or something?
And it's raised in darkness or something, yeah. I will look it up so we can talk about it at the end of the podcast, but I just want to throw that out of everything. Those are the only two things he was disappointed over he didn't get a chance to have.
Right.
Everything else in the book that he set out to eat, he did get a chance to grab. So, the elver thing was very interesting. I had no idea. I'm still shocked that you can't breed them in captivity. Ah! $400 per kilo, by the way.
Oh, wow.
400 pounds per kilo is what they were going for the previous year before he was there.
Wow.
I just looked down and saw that, so.
That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the next chapter?
The next one was almost my favorite, to be honest. New Mexico. And he goes to that giant chili trade show. And it brought up some things with hot food that I had always kind of wondered about, too.
Right. Well, we were talking about this, too, with trends. Do you remember when jalapenos first hit the mass market, and it was the hottest thing you had ever tasted, and oh my god, did it make you sweat, and you drank beer, and nothing helped, and it was just so incredibly hot. And then people started getting acclimatized to it, and they're like, well, jalapenos, those are a very tasty addition, but they're not nearly as dangerous. They've been tamed, basically. And then the habanero was the hottest thing, and I remember the first habanero I ever tried, and it was just so incredibly spicy and ridiculously hot, and people are like, oh, who would even eat that, you know, it's just so burny. But then it becomes tamed, you know, it becomes more ubiquitous, and you can taste like the fruity notes of it and everything. And then the next thing comes up. This is the ghost chilies, which I've never had, but...
And there were peppers in between the habanero and the jalapeno.
The scotch bonnets.
That hit the market. Finger chilies. I remember for a short period of time when I was younger, like, you know, early teenager, finger chilies were the thing.
Right.
They were out in the markets and everyone was like, oh, they're so hot. And they were, but...
Right. And then it just keeps getting stepped up and stepped up and stepped up, right? Until you get to the extract sauces.
Which are
even
suicide.
Ghost chilies by themselves are hotter than the extract sauces.
For people who don't know how this is measured, a Scoville unit, historically speaking, was a method used to measure the hotness of a pepper by how many squirts of sugar water it took to make the pain go away.
Right.
So a bell pepper has a Scoville rating of 0 because there's
no heat.
I want to say, depending on the jalapeno, it's anywhere from a couple hundred to a couple thousand.
Yeah.
And so on and so on. You get into the scotch bonnets.
It's a pretty wide range.
Tens of thousands. You get into the extract sauces, and they go up into the hundreds of thousands, upper hundreds of thousands, to millions.
Yeah.
Now, who's going to sit there and wait for a million squirts on their tongue to make the pain go away? They don't really use that anymore. They have a more scientific method using a machine to measure Scovilles now. And there's also another method that's tied into that. Because I was kind of curious, because it seemed not very objective. Because what's hot to you isn't as hot to me.
Right.
So if you and I were to each eat a chili pepper and then sit there with a squirt bottle for an hour on our tongue, the burn would probably fade for me sooner because I wouldn't notice it as much as compared to you.
Right.
It's all pain tolerance. So they do have a more scientific method to do it. There's
it's
even
actually
a way...
measuring like how much capsaicin's actually in it, in a chemical level.
Yes. So it's when you see Scoville units rated now, it's probably... Assuming the company is actually testing it and not just saying, well, it's made of this many peppers, we're going to go with what we know the rating is, it should be done in a lab. I would imagine the extract sauces are done in a lab like that. Because it's like, you know, food engineering at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So, Tom goes out to New Mexico to go to a chili trade show. And, wow.
Just crazy subculture of food.
Oh yeah, there are chili heads out there. There's a chili head magazine for these people, pretty much. It's all about hot peppers. I'm a freak. I have really weird hobbies. I can understand where you can have a whole magazine about chili peppers.
Yeah.
But I can see where a lot of people would scratch their head and say, what? But what I always questioned was, you eat hot food, and then you get this, at least I do, get this insane notion that it needs to be hotter. More. I want hot food now, and I want it to be hotter than it was before. Why am I doing this to myself? It's very painful.
Yeah.
I always suffer the repercussions later. But it turns out with the capsaicin in your system, it's almost like a drug.
Yeah.
And it has addictive qualities to it. Not, like, as bad as cocaine.
Not like Oxycontin or something.
Yeah.
But your brain does send out natural painkiller serotonin to combat the heat. And you do get an adrenaline rush.
Exactly.
And that's where you get the adrenaline junkie chili head.
Which is archetype. Something he covers in depth in that chapter. Very well done. I kind of feel foolish now because I've done that to myself before, but I'm still going to keep doing it because hot food tastes good.
It does. So. As long as it actually has flavor. And they covered in the extract sauces are just more like gag gifts. They sell them, and they're ridiculously expensive. They're like $300-$400.
Yeah.
But they get them and they sit on someone's shelf, and... The manufacturers are actually okay with that, because if it's not being eaten, that's one less lawsuit that they have to worry about.
With the trade show now, they give out samples, but they're not allowed to give samples of extract sauces anymore.
Mm.
But there's always somebody. There was somebody in the book who was doing it. You could tell who it was by all the people, like, falling over at his booth and waving their mouths and sweating and crying.
Yeah.
So it was really easy to crack down on who was doing it and make sure it was taken care of. I did enjoy the section with the chocolate-covered habaneros.
Yeah.
Or what, a buck of chili?
Yeah.
A buck of chili. Woman was selling chocolate-covered habaneros, and she was selling them like crazy at the trade show. People would come up and buy one or two or whatever and eat them and then just, you know,
cry.
Lose it. Because habaneros are still hot. I don't care how many ghost chilies you eat.
Right. Habaneros are still really, really hot.
Yes. It makes me kind of want to go to the trade show, though, and check it out someday. I think that would be a lot of fun.
I'd go.
Yeah. It's more like a convention than a trade show now, really.
Right.
Because it's open to the public, and you get all kinds of crazy chili people in there. So, very
Everybody's
cool.
Wearing chili covered shirts.
Paraphernalia, yeah. I have to get the...
Oh, the requisite Hawaiian shirt with chilies all over it.
Paradise on a Hanger used to have one.
Yeah.
It was one of the really loud Hawaiian shirts with all the chili peppers on it.
Mm-hmm.
Have to get one of those.
Yes.
And for those who don't know us personally, you may not know that our preferred clothing is a Hawaiian shirt. That is the approved button-down shirt of the Zwei Fat Chicks.
It's comfortable. It's breezy.
It's loud.
And it's loud.
Just like us. So. Next up from New Mexico, China. I don't remember what he was going for in China. Do you? I know you read it more recently than I.
I think he was going for the... He ended up eating bugs, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, the snake.
Oh, right.
Yeah. I forgot about that. In China, he goes for a lot of really good things. He gets the soup dumplings that I want to try so badly. But one of the things he goes specifically and ends up having is the snake wine, which is made up of a cobra, and it has the gallbladder in it, and...
That's right. Because they... Like so many other things in China, they'll have the live... creature right there and you pick them out kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So he goes relating this experience of going through this little specialty shop that sells the snake wine, and he has to pick out the cobra that's very angry with him at the time, and this woman pretty much grabs the cobra, throws it down, rips the gallbladder out of it and makes the little wine for him with it, and then whips the cobra back in another cage where it's gonna be eaten later, and he's like, oh.
It was crazy though, because I mean, she's obviously not a herpetologist or anything.
No.
She's just someone who works there, and she performs this crazy little surgery on the cobra to take its gallbladder out.
And she does it with such finesse that you can tell she's done it hundreds of times.
Yes.
And it's really expensive, so...
But you had snake wine in China, but it was the entire snake crammed into a bottle, right?
Yes, and I don't believe it was a cobra. It was just a snake crammed in. It looked like a specimen jar. And for a while, when we saw them in the store, we thought, well, you know, it's a gag gift. No, no, it's meant for your health. You're supposed to drink it.
Right.
And it tastes like dirt. I do not recommend it, unless you're bringing it back as a gag gift. I don't even know if you can get it in the country, though.
No, probably not.
Yeah.
That is not FDA approved.
Mm-hmm. And he went out to eat a lot, had some dim sum, had some other good stuff while he was there, had some really good roast duck, that sort of thing. He also kept asking people what they thought of fast food in China.
Oh, yeah. And the consensus was, our teenagers eat fast food, but then when they get a little bit older, they always come back to eating Chinese food.
Come back to the comfort food.
Yeah.
And that makes a lot
Which
of sense.
Which makes a lot of sense.
Because even look at people we know. You eat poorly as a teenager, through your 20s, and as you come into your 30s, you start to crave home food again.
Mm-hmm.
More so than you've ever done.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of you and I, how we've been eating healthier, is because we've been craving home-cooked food like that. We've wanted homemade pierogies and shepherd's pie and all that other good stuff. So that makes sense. That makes me feel a little better that Western culture's not going to wipe out Chinese tastiness.
Right. And it's because of our shared humanity.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way we are. When we're young adults, we're out and we're exploring, and we don't always have time to eat good food, so we just grab whatever's there. Or we're out and we're exploring and we're testing different cultures, but we never lose our own culture.
And we can see the perfect application of it every time we go out to eat in Markham.
Yeah.
When we go head out to Pacific Mall, you will see a lot of people who are not right off the boat immigrants, but they are that first generation that came over. But then you'll see their kids there without them.
Yeah.
You'll see whole parties and whole tables of younger people.
Teenagers.
Late teenagers or
even
in their 20s.
Their other friends.
Bringing their other friends.
Other cultures.
Because they want that home-cooked food that is with the taste that they remember from being younger.
Mm-hmm.
So it gives me hope.
Yeah.
Let me put it that way. Because after I was in China...
I didn't think McDonald's was ever going to take over China.
No, but it's popular.
It is popular.
There, and if you go to a McDonald's or a KFC in China, those are the two I saw all the time, the lines are just insane. You wait for half an hour, 45 minutes in line just to place your order. I don't know what the attraction is unless it's just a novelty.
I think it's like if you're in New York City, you go to a hot dog cart
maybe
kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's fast.
I don't know. I feel better about it, though. So okay. The China chapter was good, but it was nothing new for Sheila and I, so... Mm-hmm. I zipped through it. I enjoyed it. His writing style is fun.
Yeah.
But I was really excited for the next one, the Nashville chapter 2.
For barbecue!
Barbecue! It made me want barbecue. Reading this book made me hungry.
Yeah.
I snacked the entire time. Yes. I kept getting up and eating when I was reading on the sofa. You're like, what's wrong with you? I'm like, the book's tasty. Leave me alone. So Tom gets invited to judge a barbecue cook-off in Nashville. And it's actually...
He is one lucky Englishman.
See, it is the Jack Daniel's World Championship Invitational Barbecue. So it's not just a cook-off, it is the barbecue cook-off down there.
Yeah.
And you have to be invited, which means you have to have usually won someplace else, or
right.
be a previous winner, or an entrant, be somebody who cooked with distinction the year before, whatever.
You can't just be a Joe Schmo.
Yes.
With barbecue.
So he goes to the cook there, and he decides to... kind of get himself into barbecue shape by going to that one chicken place he had heard a lot about. I'm going to look the name up.
Totally want to go there.
Yes. Prince's Hot Chicken Shack. There we go. And he'd been to Nashville before. He'd heard this is the place to go for chicken. This is now on our bucket list.
Yes.
To go to this place before we die. About how great the chicken is. And he goes there and the mayor's there. I mean, this is the place to go for chicken. It's also not in the nicest part of town.
Right.
So usually go during the day, or that's what he's been told by everybody, go during the day. And there's a reason I mentioned that at the end. So he goes, and you can get, let's see, you can choose medium hot or extra hot. And he foolishly tries to get extra hot. And even the great niece and the man who founded it, who's taken all the orders, she even says, you sure you want that? He's like, yes, I want the extra hot. And he has all this anticipation to get this chicken, and he gets the extra hot, and he practically blacks out because it's so hot. He didn't even really
what
get to enjoy
to
it.
Something like, you can't take it back or something? Oh, it's not chat and chicken or...
She tells him, don't you all be trying to order the extra hot mine. It'll blow you clean away. And she says, you sure, honey? It's real spicy. And he's like, yeah.
She says something about how it's not chatting food.
Yeah.
You eat it, you can't even speak.
It was the mayor said that. You'll find the extra hot chicken ain't chatting food. So it comes with coleslaw and white bread to soak up the grease and pickle chips and... It just sounds so good. I almost made us go out to Popeyes to get fried chicken after reading that. I was so hungry for it. And he just doesn't enjoy it. And he feels bad because he could tell it's great chicken and it's so good, but the heat is just burning all of the flavor away. And he regrets it, but he has to kind of suck it up because he has this machismo thing. He's trying not to be the wussy British guy.
Right.
So he powers through it. Later on, before he leaves, he decides he has to have the chicken without the extra hot. And he ends up paying an exorbitant amount to a taxi driver to go to that part of town to get him chicken late at night. Because it's open until 2 or 3 in the morning or something.
Right.
But nobody else would go.
The driver's like, it's double the charge.
Yeah. So he finally gets it, and it is indeed the just foodgasm that he expected it to be.
Exactly.
But on to the actual judging of the contest. He goes through the training, and he has these incredible rules. You're not allowed to talk while you're judging. You have to watch your body language.
Yeah.
All kinds of
stuff.
They
really want you to be objective and impartial.
Very, very serious. And they tell you to pace yourself because you have to eat a lot. And of course he doesn't do that because he's so excited.
He's totally gluttonous like I would be.
Well, you can't get good barbecue in England.
Yeah.
I feel his pain. Though we did find a barbecue place out by Taunton. We're going to check out and see if they really do have good barbecue like they advertise.
Exactly.
But I digress. So there's a ton of categories. And they tell him not to fill up. Pace yourself.
Right.
First category they start judging is the barbecue sauce category, which if you're starving because you're waiting so you can judge, it's a huge letdown because you've just got, you know, little dabs of sauce to taste.
Aw.
And then the next category is, what do they call it, comedy crap?
Yeah.
Where it's non-barbecue entries that lets the chefs do whatever they want, pretty much, and everyone's all disgruntled because they want the barbecue.
Bring on the queue!
Yeah, then they start with the whole hog.
Yeah.
The ones that were the whole hogs that were barbecued, and it just goes downhill from there for the poor guy. Because the food's so good, and he's so hungry.
Or uphill, as the case may be.
And he just starts stuffing himself. They had the whole hog, then they went on, I think, to the chicken entry, and that's when he talks about princes.
Yeah.
Then they go on to ribs. And ribs. By the time ribs comes around, he's just cramming himself full.
And then there's
pork butt, brisket.
Yeah, brisket.
And then I think ribs might have been before, at the end, I don't know. But there were just so many categories, and he's just cramming himself full of meat. He's eating like 3 or 4 pounds of meat by the end of the contest. Then they bring out the dessert entries.
Yeah.
So, I don't know if I'd ever want to judge a contest like
no.
that.
I think it would take all the fun out of it.
It was really interesting to read about his experiences with it and how they're supposed to be impartial, but people are still talking during it. And at one point, he had a fantasy of like whipping a rib into the crowd to see what would happen.
He talked about how the I want to say audience, but they're not really.
Yeah, no, they're
just
kind of
like staring like starving homeless dogs.
Because whatever the judges
or like
don't
a throng of peasants.
Whatever the judges don't eat gets sent to the audience to eat.
Yeah.
So they're all sitting there going, om nom nom. And everyone's just watching, drooling, waiting, hoping they're too full to eat it all. So I would have to wear my fat jeans for sure.
I'd wear jogging pants and make you ashamed.
I liked that chapter, and it made me want barbecue pretty bad.
Definitely.
I even think I ended up making pulled pork that week after reading that.
I think you did.
So the next stop he does, and he doesn't do these all in a row.
This is months.
This is, yeah. He'd go home for a couple weeks, then he'd go back out on the road, or he'd go home for a month or so, then go back out. The next one is the obligatory eating dangerously chapter that you knew had to be in the book.
Right. If you're going to eat dangerously, this is must be in your top three, because it's dangerous to eat.
Yes. It's fugu. You have to have fugu.
Yeah. So he goes to Tokyo, and he talks all about the training that has to go through, and he has all these weird fantasies, which is another reason why I enjoyed reading it, because he has kind of an imagination like mine.
And he goes to a fugu restaurant and tries it. And apparently you feel the toxins. Even if it's prepared properly, you get a little numb. So when he first starts to feel the numbness, he starts to freak out a little bit.
He's like, oh god, this is it. This is the end of the line.
But he's fine. That would freak me out. Having had allergic reactions where my face has gone numb, I would lose it. So there will never be fugu in my future.
I can live happily all of my days without trying fugu.
Yes. But he didn't really like it that much. He thought it was kind of meh. He went to a fugu restaurant. It was just a random restaurant. He didn't really get any recommendations.
Yeah.
And somebody had asked him later on about it, about what did you think. He said, yeah, you know. So they made him go back. Not made him, but he ended up going back to another fugu restaurant.
Yeah. He's basically told he missed something, and he should try this other place to get a real taste of the divinity that is fugu, for those that are fugu enthusiasts.
And once he tries the other place, he says, yeah, it is really good. So
it makes me think that there's, like, this underground kind of, like, Yakuza-type cult that are fugu heads. I just imagine them wearing giant puffer fish hats, like the cheese heads.
This is all Sheila's fantasy at this point. Anyway.
Could you imagine?
No.
An underground convention?
No.
For people that like blowfish?
So, like, the chili convention, but with blowfish?
Yeah.
No.
But it would be, like, all underground.
So,
like an Eyes Wide Shut, but better.
Better, you know, with no sex, just fugu.
Anyway.
I wouldn't try it. I salute him for giving it a shot twice, taking his hands and life in his hands. Nobody's died
putting
from it.
Putting his life in someone else's
hands. Yeah. Nobody's died from it in, like, what, 20, 30 years?
I thought it was like 40 years.
Yes. Though he had this vivid imagination of, or vivid, daydream of him being listed as the encyclopedia entry of nobody's died in 40 years except for this British reporter.
Yeah.
So Korea was next, and he does a lot of Asian foods, and I think it's part of it's because he's a Westerner and Asian food is very exotic and very dangerous to us, and part of it's that we just have all these myths and misconceptions about it.
Right.
But he goes to Korea for dog, because that is the big no-no in Western culture. Oh my god,
that's
you ate dog?
That's a cultural taboo.
I know we joke about Chinese food and cats, and or rat and whatever food, but people freak out about dog.
Yeah. Well, I can see why.
Yeah.
They we have a different relationship with dogs than a lot of people in the East,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of other cultures that have eaten dog have. Whereas a dog is a tool of survival. Even the Inuit would eat dog on occasion. They were for transportation. They would help you hunt. And if you didn't have anything else to eat, they would save you by giving their life so that you could eat them.
In Korea, eating dog is a machismo thing. It's supposed to make you virile.
It's supposed to be on the outs, too,
mm-hmm.
from what I understood in the book.
Yes, it's not like
it's
everybody sits
very
down to dog.
Fashioned.
Mm-hmm.
Or considered to be, I'm trying to think of a Western equivalent. You're eating those carrots so that you'll have awesome eyes.
Yes.
How foolish of you. Or do you have any idea how many carrots you'd have to eat?
So he wants to eat it to try it objectively, to
right.
strip away his Western prejudices. Because he does sit there and talk about how he loves dogs, he grew up with them,
well,
he doesn't hate dogs.
Well, the Brits are huge yeah. dog fans. I mean, we were talking, or it was in the special features in Snatch, and Guy Ritchie was talking about how, you know, Bullet Tooth Tony is this total cold-blooded killer that will do anything that the guy that hires him says, and he's really squeamish about killing the dog to try and get a diamond out of it, because British love dogs.
Mm-hmm.
They love dogs almost more than they love their own kids. You had a chance to try dog in China, and you did not, but the guy that you were with did.
Mm-hmm.
And what did he say about it?
It tastes like beef. He said it tasted like really tender beef. He did it just to say he could eat it. He really had no desire to continue eating it. He wasn't going to go out and looking for a dog restaurant or ordering it specifically.
Right.
I had to be kind of sneaky about it.
Well, you weren't altogether sneaky about it.
Well, when we went out with people, they would try to be sneaky and, you just ate this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they were really pushing the issue of dog the one day, because we were at a restaurant that was known for serving dog in the area.
Right.
And my mom, when I left for China, had jokingly said, if you eat dog, you're not allowed back under my roof. She was mostly joking.
Mostly.
But my mom loves dogs. So they kept pushing the issue, and I finally had a click-click-whir moment, and the little hamster in my brain got on its wheel, and I said, no, I'm not allowed to eat dog. In the Chinese culture, there's a huge respect for people's parents and what their parents say they can and can't do, even as adults. And I said, my mom made me promise before I left that I wouldn't eat dog while I was over here, and if I do, she's not letting me back in the house. And
Everybody backed right off.
Everybody backed off, and after that dinner, because there's always one person at one dinner that's at another dinner you go to after that.
Right.
You always have a common thread in that kind of situation. So every dinner I went to after that, if there was dog on the table, they made sure they pointed it out to me. They're like, don't eat that.
Yeah.
So.
Which was rather cool of them. And
yeah.
You found, like, the cultural finishing move, I guess, that was your pass.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't untrue.
Mm-hmm.
Your parents adore dogs, and if your mom said that, I know that she meant it.
She was joking, but serious. But she knew I wasn't going to anyway.
She wouldn't kick you out, but she didn't want you to
do
it.
But I had read in a guidebook before I went to that if you were vegetarian, don't tell them I'm vegetarian because I don't like meat or I object to this. Tell them I'm Buddhist. It's for religious reasons.
Right.
And they'll back off right away the same thing.
Well,
they won't be sneaky and try to trick you. Yeah.
You know, it's not just, you're just trying to make a political statement.
Mm-hmm.
You actually have a good moral reason for doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that as well. It's just a matter of being able to justify yourself to them. Personally, I wouldn't try it either. I look at dogs the same way the Native Americans look at bald eagles. I wouldn't do it because we've raised them to be with us and to protect us in our homes. And even though I know that if I died in an apartment, my dog would probably eat me.
Oh, yeah. You would have
after a couple of days... If I wasn't found.
The Hannibal and Lecter thing.
Yeah.
So, Tom talks in this chapter not just about our misconceptions about it, but his personal objections to eating a dog, besides the whole Western thing of you don't eat man's best friend. And it's that how they're raised is horrible when they're raised for food. They live in horrible conditions, they're slaughtered in horrible conditions.
Well, it's supposed to be fear and pain is supposed to give you the best meat, which is...
makes you the most virile when you eat
appalling.
It. Yes. So they kill them in horrible ways. So he puts off the entire trip to Korea. He eats all this other stuff. Some of it sounded really good, some of it sounded really horrible. But he finally puts off at the end and finally goes, like, the day before he leaves, practically, to try dog. And it's an interesting case of how you can convince yourself and pump yourself up as much as you want. But unless you have your self-conscious convinced that it's okay, your subconscious, I'm sorry, convinced that it's okay, it's not going to work. And that's what happened to him. He goes to eat it, and all he can think of is the smell of wet dog, and he chokes some of it down, But he couldn't do it all the way. He couldn't enjoy it.
Bite. I don't think he really ate more than that. He ordered, like, dog soup or something, and he fished out a piece of meat that he said looked like kind of like a ground hamburger. It was like a tendril of meat. Mm-hmm. And he said he couldn't really eat much more than that.
Yeah, he stirs it around. He'd drop a couple tiny shreds in, but he could not even pretend to enjoy it. It was expensive.
Yeah.
It was not a cheap meal for him at all, but I think the same thing would happen to us if we tried to butch up and try dog.
No
we
way.
Wouldn't be able to choke it down.
I'm not even going to try to do it because I have too much respect for the animal mm-hmm. and its place in my culture mm-hmm. to eat it.
Yeah.
I would no sooner make myself eat dog than I would make a Native American sit down to, like, deep-fried bald eagle.
Yes.
You know? It's just not going to happen.
Yes.
Or make a Hindu eat a cow. Or make somebody who's...
Make a human eat another human who was not inclined to cannibalism.
Exactly.
There you go.
I understand that there's some cultures that do it, and I understand that sometimes in particularly Native cultures, it was a necessity, and I totally understand that, but I have no illusions that I'm going to make myself into a better person by eating dog, especially knowing how they're raised and how they're killed.
The way he describes how what was going through his mind as he's eating it and his reactions to it, it reminds me, one, of whenever I have to eat something that I really cannot stand.
Yeah.
Like tuna.
Cooked tuna.
Cooked tuna, just, I gag, I sweat. It's horrible. It's just something that I don't enjoy.
It's really a psychological
and it is a psychological
fear
reaction
response.
But
yeah.
It's a strong reaction to where I've decided
it's a fight
why
or
torture
reaction,
myself. Yeah.
Almost.
Why torture myself with it? And it also reminded me of the first time I went to try sushi with you. Because that first bite, you know, I'm putting
I had
on a
no
brave
idea, actually.
You're putting on a brave front. I put on a brave front for
you. You did.
Because I wanted to try it. But there's this little part of my lizard brain that was programmed from a child that said, you have to cook your meat before you eat it. It can be rare, but you have to cook your meat. So I'm fighting at that point, what, 22, 23 years
of programming
with this piece of raw fish on rice coming up to my mouth. And the first bite, I had all of that going through my brain. Oh my God, what am I doing? It's raw. I'm going to get sick. I'm going to get a parasite. All this craziness going through there. And then I finally was able to calm down and really taste it and enjoy it. But that first bite was torture.
Yeah.
And that's what makes me think of trying dog. It's the same thing. The first bite, but for him, all of the bites were torture because all he could do is, like, visualize dog lying by his feet. He's smelling wet dog. Yeah. Anyway.
It's truly dangerous.
Yes.
We're pushing... That's pushing the boundaries of...
Your psychological limits. Yeah. And then he goes, after that, keeping with the Eastern theme, to Laos. That's the next one.
I could almost go to Laos, but there's too many flies.
But you could eat them.
Well, everything he talks about is, like, fly-blown.
Yeah.
Like, because there's just flies everywhere, in every market... All over the place, and I despise flies. They just gross me out.
Well, Laos he considers dangerous because it really is one of the last bastions of true communism out there.
Right.
And he has these fantasies of James Bond-style agents hanging out and talking about the Cold War and everything.
Yeah.
So he goes
like
to...
Like where KGB go to die kind
yeah.
of thing. Like
they go
put
to,
them
keep,
out
their,
to pasture.
Keep their skills sharp before they die kind of deal.
Yeah.
So he goes to try the cuisine of Laos. He doesn't really go for a particular dish. There was the one from a book that he asked about, and they're like, yeah, only tourists eat that or something. I don't
okay.
remember what it was. The one soup, I think.
Yeah.
So...
Is it a bird's nest soup?
I don't remember. I don't know if I'd want to eat anything in Laos, just out of a safety thing.
I would like to try... I don't know if there's any Laotian restaurants.
I would try one in Canada.
I would definitely like to try the cuisine. Like I said, the whole country sounds too fly-blown for me to actually go and enjoy myself.
Yeah.
I'd be constantly swatting at things.
Well, the one lady he knows takes him to a restaurant kind of out in the middle of nowhere, it sounds like, on a boat. And he gets all kinds of weird dishes.
Well, the funny thing is he didn't realize that it was on a boat until all of a sudden the room that they were in started pulling away from the rest of the restaurant. And he sees the little window that there is disappearing into the distance.
Only 20 feet away from dry land do I realize that this slender private room is actually a boat with an engine at the back. Yeah.
But it's weird because it's one of the few landlocked... Or is the only landlocked Asian country. So they have seafood, but not as much of it. It seems like they have a lot of... There's a lot of mutton and a lot of, like,
fish
insects.
And insects.
Like,
yes.
Grubs and things.
Well, ant egg soup is that one thing.
Oh, okay.
And it has all the ants' eggs in it. He had read about it in a book. The book was ant egg soup, and he wanted to try it because of that. There was a water beetle. I'm trying to find the one where she's like, oh, leave the bowl on it or they'll escape.
Yeah, with some other live insect dish. The bumblebee larva actually sounded pretty good.
Ah, the rice arrives in baskets, followed by what looks like a plate full of salad covered with an upturned glass bowl. I reach over to take it off, but Lucky stops me. Careful, otherwise they go everywhere. Look closer. I peer at the bowl and suddenly realize that something is moving beneath. More to the point, lots of things, all hopping against the glass. Live shrimp salad, very fresh.
Hmm.
He said it was good.
Yeah.
It's very juicy, very sweet. It has, it's mixed with chilies and limes and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I don't know about having to chase my dinner down or all over the table like that, too.
Yeah, that is kind of weird.
And, deep-fried baby bees. That was the other one I was trying to think of, too. So he goes through literally the fear factor trip is Laos. That's the one when you think of eating dangerously. That's what I was thinking of for the whole book. And this is the only chapter that really lived up to that.
Right.
Just the extreme
eating. I would
totally
try the deep-fried baby bees, though, because think about it. They're fed on honey.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that they were like a golden, pale color.
But it sounds like a gorgeous country. From the way he describes it, the people, the food, everything, it's fairly untouched so far by Western culture.
Yeah.
There's still some Westernization going on, but not to the extent of as in China and Japan and Korea.
Right.
I'm on the fence. If we ever hit the lottery, maybe we'll go.
Even Korea's pretty touristy now.
Yes. If we hit the lottery, we'll go and eat some baby bees.
All right.
For you. We're almost done.
With some Lao beer.
Spain and Italy is all that's left. Spain and Sicily. All right. And these ones are, again, more philosophically dangerous. In Spain, he's going for a particular type of those things.
She's making claw-like movements.
A gooseneck barnacle.
Oh, right.
Persebus, I believe it's called. He's going for a gooseneck barnacle. And it's a really dangerous barnacle to gather. It's off on these rocks.
It can only be gathered at low tide, but it's in the stormy season.
Yes.
So,
and they're off the
coast
of Spain.
It's a dangerous thing to obtain.
Yes. Like, people die all the time doing this.
It's like, think Alaskan crab fishing.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. It's like Alaskan crab fishing. And he had them a while ago at a restaurant where he knows the fellow who owns it. And he talks the guy into helping him go to Spain to try to go on a trip to get these with the fishermen through the fellow's supplier. Because they're very rare, very expensive, and it's an erratic supply. You cannot guarantee you're always going to get them. The fellow who owns the restaurant gets them sporadically at best. And usually calls them up and says, hey, Tom, guess what we've got? So.
Well, and he's there for a couple of days, and they can't even go out for two of them because it's just too stormy.
There's a lot of false starts, a lot of standing
around
the dock.
They don't even let him. Like, he wanted to go out and try and pick barnacles, and they were like, no way.
Yeah.
You'll be killed. Mm-hmm. Stay on the boat where you belong.
Yes.
Leave it to the professionals.
But he got to try them fresh, like, right off the shore, pretty much.
Yeah.
And they sell for a good bit. I mean, these guys only come back with a couple kilos at a pop, and they're able to make a living off of it, pretty much. I would like to try them. I'm game to try pretty much any seafood, really.
Yeah.
It sounds interesting. It wouldn't become a regular part of the diet, obviously. I don't think we would ever have them on North America.
Probably not. We'd probably have to have them in Europe somewhere.
But it's almost like the, like you said, the European version of Alaskan crab fishing. So,
yeah.
Very interesting chapter. I never even knew those things existed.
Neither did I. I mean, I knew, obviously, that what barnacles were, but I didn't realize that people ate them.
Yeah.
Or that they were a delicacy.
And if I have any complaint with the book, it's that the last chapter's kind of anticlimactic.
It's like,
Well, he goes to Sicily because of the whole mafia,
the mafia
mentality. And it's neat, but it isn't nearly as exciting or interesting as the rest of the book.
I think he just wanted to go to Italy.
Yeah, I think he just wanted to go to Italy, too. Go to Sicily. I guess he used to vacation in Italy as a kid. And he's like, I want to go to Sicily and check out people who used to be in the mafia. And I think he's a little let down by how it is now.
I was a little bit let down by it.
That priest with the olive oil farm, that was wild.
That was pretty cool.
There's a priest who ended up getting a hold of olive tree farm that the mafia had that's now part of the government, but they're not using it for anything.
Yeah.
And he's using it to rehabilitate young men. It's kind of like a halfway house where they collect the olives and press them and they sell them to maintain the farm and everything so he can continue doing this charity work with the young men. And he's had some threats from the mafia and everything, but they're doing really well. And you can even buy the olive oil. It's exported now.
Yeah, it's high grade.
Yeah.
Extra virgin olive oil, and cold pressed.
I mean, reading that and talking to that guy, I mean, that guy's just, you know, cojones down to here to do that in Sicily to try to reclaim these properties that are just going to waste and nobody's using, so.
Well, they were talking about, too, the history of the mafia and all the misconceptions about it, because there used to be, in medieval Sicily, well, I guess even going back to ancient times, there was the Honored Society, which were basically like Italian sheriffs, which they were the good man on the block that you knew would set things right and you knew was a just man. And he would make sure that everything was taken care of, because for the longest time, they were invaded so many times and they were ruled by so many foreign governments.
Mm-hmm.
They could never really get justice if something happened to a member of their family. And then it became perverted when it became into the criminal element that we know is the mafia or La Cosa Nostra, with drugs and all kinds of other criminal acts.
And these kids can't get work after they've been caught because they're all labeled as druggies.
Yeah.
The guys the father's working with. But the name of the olive oil is called Libera Terra, and it is an organic olive oil. And it says on there, it has in Italian the words, from land confiscated from the mafia. Yeah. And they have had mafia threats on the land. They did come in and burn a tractor and cut down a bunch of trees, but they're still doing really well. So I thought that was the coolest part of that chapter, that there's this priest out there who's like, screw you guys, and he's trying to help rehabilitate the youth in Sicily. It's kind of neat. So.
It's like trying to, after a forest fire has come through and totally destroyed it, he's trying to coax some new life out of it.
Yeah.
Out of some wasted land that's been destroyed.
Still love the book, even though the last chapter was anticlimactic. I recommend it to anybody. I was excited because you and I are becoming very food savvy, in both in terms of other cultures and exotic foods out there, just from our reading and our eating whenever we find strange stuff. And I was excited to learn new things.
It's also nice that there's somebody else out there, too, that shares our passion.
Yes. The dude's a fat chick. He doesn't know it. He'll never know
Tom,
it.
Tom, you're an honorary fat chick.
He's an honorary fat chick, so... In his articles, I've read a bunch of them through the archive online, and it's hilarious. The ostrich egg. Did we talk about that yet?
I don't think we did.
The first one I found was he had ordered an ostrich egg from this one farm in England that specializes in specialty eggs and exotic eggs and all that, those neat things. And he gets this giant egg. I could have swore we talked about this in an episode.
Maybe we did.
I think we did. Well, anyway, if you heard it, we'll repeat it. He goes through different tools to figure out how to crack it, and then he doesn't know what to do with it, because what do you do with a giant ostrich egg? You can't cook with it.
Does he say, what am I going to do, make an omelet for 20 people?
Make a soft-boiled egg use a baguette for a dipper in it? Because it's huge. It's the size of a bowling ball.
Yeah.
I don't even remember what he decided to do with it again. Wasn't it just an omelet?
Two dozen eggs or something?
Yes. One ostrich egg is two dozen eggs. His final verdict on it was that it didn't taste that good.
Yeah.
You're better off, if you want something to taste really good, to order from the same farm and get their specialty chicken eggs for two dozen. It's cheaper to get that than the ostrich egg.
I've always wanted to try pickled quail eggs, like Japanese pickled quail eggs.
Good luck finding quail eggs, though. Those are kind of hard to lay hands on.
There's some out in California. Maybe we'll try them if we go to the States and go to the West Coast.
Cool. Or I don't like pickled egg.
There's actually quail farms up here, too.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I've never even had quail.
I've never eaten it. We had them as kids, as pets. They jump really high.
Okay. That's like finding out my mom had a pet alligator as a kid.
Yeah, they're called button quails. They're just little things like that. It's like the equivalent of a guinea pig, but a bird.
All right. Anything else you want to add about the book? I feel bad. I hope this is as interesting for people to listen to as it was for us to read. I hope we didn't dilute it too much and turn people off of it, but it's so worth checking out.
Check it out. Definitely.
I think of all the books we've read lately for the podcast, this is my second.
Besides Fair and Cheer of Old England.
The Good Fair and Cheer of Old England is absolutely my favorite book so far. This is my second favorite because it was just so cool.
Yes.
And easy to read and well written and fun. We'll put tons of links up with this so you guys can go check out some of the stuff we talked about. This is Tracy.
And this is Sheila. And we are Spy Fat Chicks. Thanks for listening.
We hope you enjoyed the Spy Fat Chicks podcast. Please add us as a friend on MySpace and or Facebook. You can also follow us on Twitter. Please email your comments, questions, or suggestions to zweifatchicks@gmail.com. That's zweifatchicks@gmail.com. Our theme music is Hot Swing by Kevin MacLeod. Our podcasts, like Mr. MacLeod's music, are protected under a Creative Commons attribute copyright. You can make copies of our shows and share them with friends, but please make sure that credit is given. Once again, thank you for tuning in, and we hope you have a great day.